2.
I think we can all agree that children should be treated fairly. The Supreme Court is about to consider a case that will decide whether parents can choose the best education path for their children. Hi, I'm Stuart Shepard, and this is First Liberty Live. Thank you for liking and sharing our videos. We appreciate you. You're an important part of this project. And when you share this with friends and family, it helps the whole thing grow, and that helps get the word out. And if you care about these messages, they will too. This is a big week for us here at First Liberty Institute. Next Wednesday, we'll be at the Supreme Court with a case that is going to impact school choice, families, religious freedom, and we wanted you to get the inside scoop on that. So we changed things up this week, and we're doing this special episode. So we moved the chairs around and set everything up in a slightly different way to have a literal roundtable conversation. With me, I've got Kelly Shackelford, who is president, CEO, and chief counsel here at First Liberty Institute, and also Leah Patterson. She's an attorney who has been on this case since the very beginning. So hi, Kelly. Hi, Leah.
Hi, Stuart.
It is good to have you here. When the Supreme Court decides a case, it starts out with a story somewhere in the country, but when they make the decision, it has an impact that goes far beyond what that story had at the beginning. So we're going to talk about that a bit. Leah, first, let's just start out and get the story. It starts out in Maine. Describe the situation there in rural parts of the state and the problem that they were trying to solve.
Sure. So many counties in Maine are so lightly populated that they can't actually justify having a high school of their own. So what the state does is it will pay tuition to the school of the parent's choice. That could be a public school, that could be a private school, but there's a catch. It can't be a religious school. So that is the exclusion that we are challenging in this case. So,
Stuart, let me add something to that, because this will be what's shocking to people. Because they don't have a public school in most of what we would call school districts.
And this is unusual for most of us to picture, but it's when we say rural, I mean, if you look at a map of upstate Maine, it is rural. There are hardly any roads.
And
up
most
there.
Of their districts, there's no public school.
Yeah.
So they've allowed for like 100 years you to pick public or private. But not only that, you can go out of state. You can take your schooling online from somewhere else, from another country.
Yeah.
Okay. But they will allow you to have your tuition covered up to that amount. And that's the way it's been for 100 years until a few decades ago, they decided, you know what? We're going to pass a new statute and just exclude the religious schools, the sectarian religious schools. In other words, the religious schools that actually are serious about their faith.
And the fear,
that's what the case got, how it got set up.
And their concern, their expressed concern is that would have government money supporting religion, right?
Oh, that's the argument. That was their argument back then, was that, well, it would violate the Establishment Clause. But now the cases make clear, no. So there's now no reason that they should be discriminating against all the religious schools. But I think that history is important because 100 years ago, I mean, forever, they treated everybody the same. And now they're trying to see if they can get away with discriminating against the religious schools. And by the way, if you're religious in name only, you're okay.
Meaning if you don't really teach the faith that you're based on.
And you could teach everything that the public school down the street is teaching.
Yeah.
But if you add one class on religion, you're out.
How significant is this to the case that the government provides the funding, but the parents decide, the families decide where it goes to? Isn't that, I'm not an attorney, but that strikes me that's an important part of this, right?
Of course. Well, it means that the government cannot have any argument that they're choosing, the government is choosing to support religious schools. That's the choice of the parents. And the Supreme Court's held multiple times that when it is the parents' choice, the government cannot argue that it's an Establishment Clause violation.
And I've heard school choice people for a long time saying that the best way to improve education in the country is to let the parents decide where the money goes. And that goes far beyond this case, but it's been part of that thinking for a long time that as long as the families are choosing, everything gets better because it leads to competition.
It does. And look, parents know best for their children versus some government bureaucrat in an office that's never met your children. And so in this case, take our clients, the Nelsons.
Yeah.
This discrimination has really affected them. They couldn't put their child in the school that they knew and believed was best for their child. And so they had to put their daughter in a different school. And, you know, she's now all the way through. Now, their other child they have in Christian education. But they had to make that decision because, I mean, you know, they're farmers, they do a snow plow, they don't have the money to go and pay these things when the government takes away what they're entitled to, which is to be treated like everybody else in the state.
And when it gets down to the essence of it, it's about fairness. We're just asking that they be treated the same as the family down the road.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, this is, you rarely see in our cases, you rarely see a state statute which discriminates against religion on the face of the statute. Usually they're much more subtle, it's hidden, it's indirect.
Yeah.
This is clear. And so the way that works legally is when the government specifically discriminates on the basis of religion, all the burdens shift to them to prove a compelling interest that requires them to do that, and that they're doing it in the least restrictive way. They can come nowhere near meeting that burden. So what they've tried to do in this case is all kinds of subterfuge and don't look behind the curtain, kind of stuff. So
yeah.
their big argument was, and their brief, was not to argue that they had a compelling interest, not to do any of that, but to say, well, we're just trying to provide public education. And you're like, well, no, you're not. You're allowing all these private schools to, and there's no requirements. There's no curriculum requirements for you to participate in the program. People assume they're requiring them. No, they're just saying everybody can participate as long as you're not really religious.
Wow. Now, Leah, there's an aspect to the work we do that most people probably never think about, and that is finding the right client to represent. Because it's easy after the fact to think, wow, that was a great client that you had there because they really presented this well. But somebody has to go find that person. And that led to a road trip for you and one of our colleagues. Tell us about that trip.
Oh, that's right. This was in summer of 2018. Keisha and I were road tripping. Russell, one of my colleagues, and I were road tripping through Maine. See, we had heard about this discriminatory statute, and we were talking to schools, we were talking to parents, and we were looking for really for someone who had the right facts, who was in the right position to challenge this law. And so we crisscrossed Maine a couple of times and came home with the client.
And then finally you got there, and tell me about that first meeting with them. What was it like?
Well, I believe it was in a coffee shop, and it's always striking to hear the client's heart, to see what they're experiencing, what they're suffering, and where they're coming from. And you could hope for no better clients than the Nelsons.
You used a word that's a term of art, if you will, in the legal profession. That is, they had the right facts. Unpack what that means in real life.
It means that, well, not anybody can just sue the state for doing something that they think the state is doing wrong. You have to satisfy a number of legal criteria to actually qualify to file a lawsuit in the first place. So that's what we were looking for.
Okay, so you're looking for somebody who's affected by it.
Right.
But you also have to find somebody who's willing.
Yes.
And how is it, you know, when you've got the perfect client who meets everything that you need to bring the case and to be a voice for all the people who either are unable to or unwilling to do that?
Well, you know, in my experience, God calls ordinary people to do these extraordinary things. And really what tells me that I found just the right client is that their heart's in the right place. They're doing it for the right reason. And they have the commitment to go the distance, because these cases are really hard. This case has been remarkably fast. By the time we get a decision from the Supreme Court, it will only have been 4 years since we met them.
Yeah.
However, most cases take a lot longer. And 4 years is still a long time for a family that has students in school.
Yeah.
So it takes a lot to face up to community pressure, to face up to the long time that it's going to take. And that's what we're looking for.
And the truth is, the win is for families that come after, for the most part. I mean, it may help them for a couple of years, but it's really the families that come after that the win is for.
Yeah, I mean, think of the Nelsons are impacted by this with their own children, and they're fighting for that. There are a lot of people in Maine that can't choose the education that's best for their children, who haven't even asked because they know they can't get it, that as soon as they win this case, as we win this case,
yeah,
they get their freedoms restored, and they can now choose what's best for their children. But that's just Maine. This also sets a precedent for the entire country. And what it will really set is that, look, if you do a school choice program of any sort in your state, you can't discriminate against the religious schools. You can't say we're not going to allow Christian schools or Jewish schools or what. You can't do that. It will change the whole country and really stop the kind of discrimination that's been going on for many, many decades. And I'm hopeful that's why the court took this case. And, you know, it's unusual to be able to say this with confidence, but I mean, everybody who's a part of First Liberty is a part of making history next week. I mean, this is going to be a landmark decision. It's going to affect the future, whichever way it goes. We feel confident we're going to win because the law and the Constitution are on our side. But this is changing history, and this is why people are a part of what we're doing, because the Nelsons are standing for the whole future of the country.
Now, so that's the backstory. It starts in Maine. Now we're going to travel down the East Coast, and you're hinting at this already, to Washington, D.C. at the Supreme Court. And right now with COVID, nothing in Washington is normal. Not that anything is ever normal in Washington to begin with, but it's especially unusual right now with all the restrictions and everything. That you'll be in the courtroom next week. Describe for us what it will be like. How different will it be from usual in there?
It'll be very unusual. First, it's a little unusual in that we are co-joining in the case with another group called the Institute for Justice.
Yes.
They focus a lot on school choice cases and some other cases. They're not religious freedom oriented like we are. So it's a good combination. And Michael Bendis is their lead lawyer. And they limit us to two lawyers aside in the courtroom. So it's just myself and Michael in the courtroom. No general public. And we all have to be tested the day before. We all have to wear N95 masks.
Wow.
So this is a very different experience. But
Will the justices be wearing masks?
I don't know. I hope not, but doubt so. Because the people who speak, when you get up to make the argument, you take the mask off.
Okay, so, I'm just trying to get a picture.
It would be direct. Yeah. But I do think it's important because they just reinstalled this year. During COVID, it was all telephone. And, you know, I was before the court the first time 25 years ago, and there's something very unique about what happens when there's a direct and an interact. People don't know this, but you can only see about four judges. You're so close. You can only see about four justices, you know, without having to turn your head.
Yeah.
So this is a very intimate conversation. It's very quick. There's a lot of back and forth.
It's stress-inducing.
It is. And there's something really meaningful and I think very helpful about it. And I know you'll get to this, but that's one of the fun things is all the supporters of First Liberty can actually listen live to the argument, which normally you can't do.
Yeah.
That's going to be available. So very unique what's going to be going on Wednesday, not only because of the history, but because of how it's being done.
Yeah, and many people may not know, but you're actively involved in keeping the history of the Supreme Court with the Supreme Court Historical Society. You serve on the board for that. So I've had the privilege of being in the room when you gave people a tour of the Supreme Court chamber and what it's like to be in there. For those who've never had a tour, just draw the scene for us with words. What's it like to be in that room? What do you see?
It's really hard to describe. I mean, I would encourage everyone, if they get a chance when things are back open, to go to D.C., to make sure and go into the courtroom. Everybody is allowed to take a tour and to go in the courtroom.
Which I didn't know for the longest time you could take a tour.
Yes.
I mean, I've been to Washington many times before I realized there's a tour? I had no idea. I figured it was off limits.
You can't just go in that courtroom anytime you want.
Yeah.
But it's really majestic. It's beautiful. Obviously, huge, tall ceilings with columns and lots of visuals, including there's bronze gates on the side with little Ten Commandments at about eye level all the way around, as well as on the doors. Now, some of the people will tell you that those are the Bill of Rights, but the Bill of Rights, as far as I remember, weren't in tablet form.
God's finger.
But it's really beautiful. And the way it works is, if you were to sit and wait for what happens is at 10 a.m. Eastern, a gavel hits
on the second. Yeah.
And if you haven't been there before, you don't realize is there are curtains behind the bench.
Big red curtains.
And behind those curtains are all the justices waiting for the gavel to hit. And when it hits, boom, they all pop out. They sit in the chairs, they sit down, and you start.
And there, if I may interrupt, there's a tradition right before they come out. Tell us about that. What do they do right before they come through the curtains?
Well, I mean, the marshal says, hear ye, said, God save the United States and this honorable court. They say a prayer.
And they also shake hands behind the curtain.
Yes.
That's what I was getting
But for the general public, for those who are there, there's a prayer.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing you do when you start. And then they sit down. And then if you're the first person up, or even if you're the second, you say, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. And then you start your argument. And what people don't understand is they think that, like, you give a speech for 30 minutes and the justices clap or cry or, you know, that's not what happens. What happens is they haven't talked to each other the entire time as they've been reading all the briefs and all the arguments. And they each have four of the brightest young lawyers in the country working underneath them.
Yeah.
And the first time they really get to speak to one another is through you as you're arguing. You might think they're asking you a question.
But they're really signaling.
They're really sending, they're really communicating with each other. So what you have to do is answer the question, but realize also what is going on and where your numbers are and what the arguments are. So for instance, when we had our case with the Bladensburg Cross, if you didn't know what was going on, you wouldn't have recognized this, but if you've been there a number of times, you would. About a third of the way through the argument, it was clear we had five votes to win.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, if you understood what was happening, is Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan started arguing for a narrow ruling. So they, all of a sudden, they were willing to switch sides and to join the sides of the more conservative justices.
To limit it.
To limit the ruling.
Yeah.
But you have to understand that kind of thing. So it, as people are listening, you can listen for those things, but realize they're somewhat trying to nail down each other and convince each other by their questions to the advocate.
Yeah. Now to be clear, while Kelly is out front, up at the front of the courtroom, sitting at the table, wearing a suit and climate-controlled conditions, I'll be out on the sidewalk outside in December in Washington, D.C., hanging out with our camera. We wanted to give you an inside look at how this works. So we'll be coming to you live next week because of when the argument is. It'll be on a different day than usual. It'll be on Wednesday morning. And we'll spend about 15 minutes before that 10 o'clock time hits Eastern to talk about the case. It'll be Jeremy Dice and me, and we may have some other folks as well, who will be talking about it, just setting the scene for you. And then as the argument starts, because they're going to be streaming the audio, we're going to include that in our stream on First Liberty Live so that you can listen in. Now, there will be parts of it that are pretty legal and all that, but it will also be, it's fascinating. My son and I listened to an argument recently, and you don't have to be an expert to kind of follow the gist of what's going on, even though sometimes they wander off a bit into the weeds. But it's fascinating to hear that process in action. And we wanted to bring that to you since this is an unusual time. It's rare for the court to do real-time audio.
They don't.
This is highly unusual.
Yeah, they don't do it. And so that's what's so... You know, we did this, for those who remember this, when the Coach Kennedy argument occurred at the Federal Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit, because COVID shut down the courtrooms, and usually people never can go to a Federal Court of Appeals argument. It's a small courtroom, doesn't hold that many. And we said, you know, we can do this because it's now all, you know, online because of COVID. And so we gave a little, here's what you're going to see. And then everybody got to actually listen, maybe watch in that case.
Yeah, it was
the
Zoom.
Argument.
Yeah, they were the little Brady Bunch squares on the screen.
And the thing I was blown away by was I had a lot of supporters who I talked to afterwards because I watched the argument and was like, oh, that was, you know, it was so obvious to see the bias in some of these judges. And sure enough, it came out in the opinion.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if non-lawyers, you know, got it. I mean, immediately when it was over, I was getting, I'm so mad at it. It was so biased. They could see through all the same. So yeah. I think people can see more than they think they can. In this case, it'll be a little harder because you're listening. But again, I think you'll be able to tell because you know what this case is about. It's not that complicated. And really, the work that's been done all the way up has been tremendous. I mean, Leah and Keisha and the team and everything they've done to set this case up. And they'll be, while the argument's going on, well, our office, which is right down the street.
Which is what I was going to ask next. Leah, you are going to be.
She is.
It's
with clients.
A very short walk from the Supreme Court to our D.C. office, which I've been there a few times. It's a nice little spot. But you'll be there with the attorneys from Institute for Justice, as well as, you mentioned, the clients. What will be happening there, and what will you be listening for as you listen to the arguments from that location?
Well, that's right. We will be listening in from that location and taking a ton of notes, I'm sure. But really what we're going to be listening for is, you know, what Kelly mentioned earlier, those attempts to limit what could be a really good opinion. So we'll see what happens. There are a lot of legal procedures that the court's probably going to be asking questions about, and we'll be trying to get a feel for where each justice is on these issues.
These always come down to one key question. What's the key question in this case that has to be answered by the court?
Well, the key question is what room is left after the court's decisions in Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza for states to discriminate against religious schools.
Espinoza out of Montana, and what was the other one?
Trinity Lutheran.
Okay, yeah,
out of Missouri.
Missouri, yeah.
So those cases were very clear that the state cannot exclude religious participants from generally applicable programs. And so that's really going to be the question here, is what space is left, if there is any space.
And that, to give context for that, both of those were in favor of more religious freedom,
that's
correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Absolutely.
So that sets the groundwork for this, that we expect the court to lean that way, perhaps, maybe?
Yeah,
I mean, you can't predict.
So. If you set a program in place, you shouldn't discriminate against religion. And you have the ability to decide whether you set your program in place. They don't have to do a school choice program. But if you do one, discriminating against religion is wrong and it's unconstitutional. And we believe that's what the court should decide, and we're hopeful that they will. They've been moving in that direction. And I think we have excellent justices on this, and we'll hopefully handle the argument well. And we probably won't know until maybe June or July, end of June. So if people ask, hey, did you get a decision? No, it doesn't happen that way.
Yeah.
They will go into a private room on Friday, just the justices, no one else. They will take an informal vote, and then that will set the majority and the dissent, and they will each start writing on their opinions.
Yeah.
They will then share that to try to convince each other to flip sides, and that happens.
Or join together to make a narrower opinion.
Exactly.
Like you talked about.
And then probably in late June, we'll get an opinion. So I would encourage people to be praying for the argument, be praying for the justices, be praying even after this, because that horse trading and thing can really change things until we get that decision. But I'm really prayerful and hopeful that this is going to be a great precedent for religious freedom.
Now, we'll be hearing the audio from that, but you'll be seeing their faces. Do the justices have a tell, if you will? Is there something you look for that lets you know where they're coming in on this?
I just think people, you can read body language. You can read, you know, when you take words and body language, you can see what, you can understand where people are coming from.
Yeah.
People just did that in the big abortion argument that occurred this week. A lot of people felt like they could read from questions and things. You never know for sure. But I think we'll be able to understand where they're coming from by their questions, especially because there's been a number of other cases leading up to this. And hopefully this is going to be the end of what has been really many decades of discriminating against religious schools in these general programs. And I think they've sort of shut the door on most of it. This is the last element left, and hopefully they'll shut the door on it here.
One thing I'll be listening for, and not to wander too far afield, but you mentioned that case yesterday, the Dobbs case out of Mississippi. The first voice after the opening, Clarence Thomas. Highly unusual to hear. He's known for not speaking during the arguments. He generally doesn't ask questions, but yesterday he was right in there. I'll be listening for his voice next week when this case comes up too.
There's something I will tell people that's a little different that's going on right now that might be a long-term approach that the court uses, but it is a shift.
Yeah.
It used to be that when you get up to start your argument, within, you know, usually 20 to 30 seconds.
They cut right in, right?
Yeah. And again, our argument will be done by Michael Bendis, we've been through numerous moots. He's really ready.
Explain what a moot is for those.
A moot is when you go and you pretend like you're doing an argument and you have some of the brightest legal minds pretending they're the justices. And it's much more brutal than a real argument because it's really hostile.
Yeah.
And it gets you ready for every difficult question. And we've done 6 major moots. There's another one at Georgetown tomorrow.
Yeah.
That'll be the last one. So Michael, he's
do
ready.
Do law students go to those to sit in, or
yeah.
who's in the room?
Absolutely, that's what you do. We did one at Harvard. The law students love to watch, but they're typically professors.
Yeah.
And like one of the panelists we'll have tomorrow is a guy who was in the Solicitor General's office of the United States who. 2 years ago when the Espinoza, the big case, came before the court,
yeah.
He argued on behalf of the government.
Okay.
So he's very knowledgeable about this, and he'll be on there. And so those really do prepare people and get them ready. And I think it'll be It'll be something that people can watch, but it's different in that that interruption doesn't occur now. They give you...
I noticed that.
Essentially,
and it seemed unusual that they let them finish that whole thing, and then they said, all right, come at me.
That's what they do now. They say they will give you up to like 2 minutes of your 30 minutes to lay out your case. Then, let's say you finish in a minute and a half. You then say, I'm now ready to answer questions.
Yeah.
And then they'll do questions.
Is that a John Roberts thing, or is that a whole court
Well,
thing,
it's
you know?
Somewhat, it is, because what the second part of this is the other thing.
Yeah.
They ask questions, but at the end, they will allow each of the justices in order, seniority-wise, to ask any final questions.
Right.
And the part of the reason they did this is they felt like that the female justices were being sort of overridden or over-talked or whatever, and weren't getting the same amount of time per justice. So they wanted to make sure that sort of everybody had their turn, and that somebody wasn't speaking over someone else, because you can get energetic. Like, we could be energetic right now, and two of us could talk at the same time, and so they changed it to try to make it fair for all the justices.
That explains to me, because I heard Chief Justice Roberts going down the roll, if you will, saying,
exactly.
Alito, Coney Barrett, you got... And that explains what I was hearing.
Exactly. Then. That's what they're trying to do it in a way that they feel is more equitable.
All right. Very interesting. You've dealt with this a little already, but I'd like to hear from both of you on this. What are the... And we'll posit that we would win this. Okay, so we'll start with that. I don't want to push it too far. But what is there to be won? What could be, and you've hinted at this already, but what are the ramifications of this case nationally with the victory?
Well, I think the main thing is that it would establish a precedent, finally establishing, you know, after Trinity Lutheran, after Espinoza, that it is wrong for the government to exclude religious participants from its program, really for any reason. So that would be important.
Does that go beyond schools?
I think it affects across the board. Trinity Lutheran, for instance, wasn't a school case. It was whether you can use stuff to do a playground, right? And can you exclude the church because they're religious from the same program that everybody else?
It was about making the playground soft, rubbery material out of tires.
We want all kids to be safe. We don't care if they're at the church, school, or where they are, right?
Yeah.
That's the way it should be. So, yes, but I would just tell people this. We started off to where, for many years, we would do school choice and we would exclude and discriminate against religious schools. Then you had the Supreme Court say, you know, that's not right. That's discrimination on the basis of religion. And therefore, you don't have to exclude all the religious schools, because they were saying constitutionally you had to.
Right.
And so now we're to the point of, okay, you don't have to, but can you? And the answer is, and Espinoza was no. That was a few years ago. So you'd think, well, that ended this, right? No. What they said is, well, if you're being discriminated against because of your religious status, that you're religious, then that's clearly a violation. But we've never decided a case on whether it's because you use the funds for religious purposes. So our argument is, it doesn't really matter, okay? You can't discriminate against a group because they're religious or because they do religious things.
Mm-hmm.
It's still discrimination on the basis of religion, and it violates the Free Exercise Clause. So we're hopeful this last sort of loophole will be looped, and no more discrimination will be allowed in any of these government programs. Treat religious people, religious entities, the same that you treat everybody else.
We're coming up on calendar year end. Is there anything you'd like to say to our supporters directly as we go into this?
Just this is why you support First Liberty. I mean, this is going to affect a lot of kids. This is going to affect a lot of families. This is going to affect a lot of religious organizations, churches, synagogues, their schools. And this is just one case.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't, I mean, we've got the Navy SEALs case. We've got the OSHA mandates. We've got, we could go through lots of lawsuits.
We've got the request for Coach Kennedy that's about to be.
Sitting at the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know people are looking at end of the year, and especially this year, because they're talking about changing the tax laws, and people are like wanting to get their donations in. Just consider us. God's been really great. We're really grateful for what God has been doing. He's been really showing us favor with victories this year. And I think it's a key time. I think it's one of those times where everybody can see the darkness and the attacks and everything else, but I see it the other way. We've got good judges and justices on the court right now. We've got some great cases. I see us really just making advances for religious freedom right now with some great precedents that hopefully will be in place, you know, for our grandkids and our great-grandkids. So invest in the future, be involved, and again, we're a 501c3, so tax deductible, and share it with other people who want to be involved in setting history like we are really this next week.
So a bunch of us will be in D.C. next week, and we want to bring you along. So we're going to be doing, as I mentioned, First Liberty Live out in front of the Supreme Court leading up to the arguments. If you haven't already, you can subscribe to First Liberty Live. Just go to firstlibertylive.com if you're not there already and click on the blue subscribe button. Some say it's teal. We can argue about that later. We'll get a court decision on what color it is, really. But click on that subscribe button, and we'll send you an email reminder so that you know when and where and how to pick it up. It'll also be available online, of course, after the fact if you want to tune in later. It's 2021. That's how we do things. About to be 22. So we'll be live on Wednesday morning because that's when the argument is. And also, just so you know, we'll also be doing an after the argument segment that'll be live on Facebook afterward. And we'll do that sometime probably 11:30 Eastern, give or take. And Kelly and Leah have agreed to hang out with me for that. And we may bring in some others as well. So we'll share with you their impressions after the fact. That particular live we'll put on First Liberty Live after it's all done. Did you follow all that? I have people who keep notes for me, and that's helpful. So if you're not already subscribed, go to firstlibertylive.com, click the subscribe button. If these issues matter to you, would you please consider clicking on the red give button as well, because you can be a part of this as we defend families all across America. Kelly, Leah, thank you for the work that you do. There's so many aspects to it that I know people don't see. It is an honor to work alongside you in these cases. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Stuart.
All right, and thank you for being part of this effort. We will see you next week. Right here on First Liberty Live.